Please come to order. Would you please call the roll for the House?
Representative Price Tompkins, Representative Gaddis, Representative Hughes, Representative Isaacson.
Here.
Representative Keller.
Here.
Representative Millett. Chair Lynn.
Here. Okay. With that, I'm going to hand the gavel over to my friend and colleague, Senator Dyson, who will chair the remainder of the meeting.
Yeah, thank you. Present from the Senate here is Senator Giesel and myself, Dyson. We're ably supported here this morning by Lori Rowland and Heather Parker, and very experienced folks, and appreciate your help. This morning we're going to be continuing hearings about the land issues that the state is working on, and I think somewhat heroically, and we've asked Department of Natural Resources and Department of Law to make a presentation to us. So please, gentlemen, put yourself on the record, and we're eager to hear your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's indeed an honor to be here before you, and we appreciate your time, this busy time of the session. My name is Scott Ogan. I'm the manager of the Public Access Assertion and Defense Unit and DNR. Been with that position about 6 years after serving 10 years in service in this branch of the government.
Excuse me. Now, for the record, Representative Christ Tompkins and Representative Isaacson have joined us. And here comes Senator Coghill.
And Representative Lynn.
And Representative Gaddis. And Representative Hughes.
Presume we have a full house here.
Yep. Please continue, Mr. Ogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, again, it's indeed an honor, with as busy as you folks are down here, for you to take time to listen to us. I'll try to skip over the portions of the presentation that I gave earlier in the year. And see if I can remember where I left off. The equal footing doctrine is that all states are admitted to the union on equal footing with the other states. And in Alaska, it expressly said in the Stated Act that it included the 1953 Submerged Land Act, which granted title to the submerged lands beneath navigable waters.
Excuse me, Mr. Ogan, do we have a copy of this in our packet?
Yes, I believe you do. I'm down about six pages, probably.
Oh.
It's the one with the bear on the front, my packet.
All right.
Okay.
It's here.
Let me know when you're ready.
Yeah, go ahead. I'll just give you a clean my glasses what I was doing. But go ahead and find it. Here with the bear on. Okay.
All right, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the big problem is they didn't really know which waters were navigable for tidal purposes, and so we're left with the task of sorting that out. And there's been, you know, it's kind of waxed and waned over the years. Attention has been paid to it. It's based on a Daniel Ball case that's actually a Civil War case. I think it was on the Mississippi River, but if the river was capable of being used for travel, trade, and commerce, it is considered navigable for tidal purposes. In other words, the state owns it if it's useful. And the problem with Alaska is we have so many rivers that we have very little actual historical information, and so it's a very intensive job to research that history. And we employ three people from the Department of the Office of History and Archaeology within DNR to assist us with that research. And until we're running out of money that the feds, that Ted Stevens appropriated for that effort, we just about used that up. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there's an increment in the budget to the state to pick up that effort. Utah is an interesting case. Salt Lake, there was we're not allowed to claim lands that were previously withdrawn before statehood, but there was a power site reservation in Utah on Salt Lake that was determined that it did not defeat state title. there has to be a clear and convincing argument that Congress expressly intends to defeat the state title. Otherwise, it's fairly good chance on the state side to be able to prove that the state owns the riverbed. Kanduk Nation were two rivers that the Ninth Circuit agreed was navigable. It was appealed to the Supreme Court, and cert was denied, so it's pretty much settled case law. As you may know, there's a case on the Nation River with John Sturgeon, and he was threatened to be cited for operating his hoovercraft on the Nation River, which is clearly a state sovereign river, and they're basically using the reserved water rights doctrine as a way to an authority that gives them the right to regulate, and that essentially means that if water came off federal lands and it's in a state river, that extends their jurisdiction into that river. Case law precedents in Anelka was set by the Katie John case, and that's the authority that they claim to own the rights to manage our subsistence fisheries in our river. Gulf Cannon River was the earliest river that we achieved a quiet title action on about 25 years ago, which is really, the last quiet title action we had on a river. And that was an important case because it talked about susceptibility. It didn't actually have to be used for travel, trade, and commerce, but if the river is in its natural and ordinary condition at statehood and it hasn't changed since then and you can use it now, it's susceptible to navigation, therefore it's state-owned. So susceptibility is an argument we get a lot of pushback on, but we have made some progress with BLM on in a recordable disclaimer of interest program for them to grant us title, you know, clear the clouds to our title based on susceptibility. PPL Montana is a very recent case, U.S. Supreme Court. PPL Montana is a power company. They sued state of Montana, which was trying to collect back revenues and rents for space for a dam, you know, and claiming that it's navigable in that section of the river because most of the river is navigable, but that particular section was not, and that's what the court ruled. And so it kind of retooled our thinking we used to think that if a river was navigable and there was certain non-navigable portions, we would claim it the whole river bed. So we've retooled our thinking somewhat, so there may be segments of a navigable river that you can't pass that normally was portage or something, which may not be ours. And so by riparian law, the upland landowner owns the bed of the river if the state doesn't. So in that case, there was millions of dollars worth of back rent on the table, but we're pretty happy with where it went because it really strengthened the susceptibility argument, and the Supreme Court said that modern-day boats, if they ply that river and navigate the river, that's state-owned. So generally, we're pretty happy with the clarity. I always get a question, is that river navigable? And I have to ask the question, for what purpose? Is it navigable for title, or if it's navigable for public trust purposes, and we have three different types of submerged lands. There's submerged lands, which are we consider the lands beyond the mean low tide mark in salt water. Those are technically in statute submerged lands. Tidelands are the lands between the mean low and mean high. And shorelands, by statute, the definition is any freshwater, rivers, lakes, and those kind of things. So, and is it navigable for ownership or public trust purposes? So we always get in these discussions about whose land is it. This is a flood stage, which is almost permanent state and sewer.
Excuse me, Mr. Hogan?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Then the land between mean high and low water is always public land.
Correct.
And public access.
Correct. The state owns the tidelands, and we own all the way to the mean high water mark, and then mean high tide mark.
Yep.
And people get too, I even get them confused. mean high tide versus ordinary high water. Ordinary high water is the riparian boundary, and I'll cover that a little bit later in the presentation.
And riparian mean? Riparian means?
That's the line between the submerged lands and the uplands. That's the riparian boundary.
Okay.
So this definition is in our section. It's actually taken out of the Daniel Ball case. It means water that, at the time of state, the state achieved statehood was used or susceptible to being used in its ordinary condition as a highway for commerce over which travel and trade were or could have been conducted in the ordinary modes of trade and travel in the water. And use or potential use does not need have to be without difficulty, extensive, or long and continuous. That's the Daniel Ball Supreme Court case law that was established back in Civil War days. So we go out and do a lot of hydrological work. That's our hydrologist. But public trust navigability, there's two sections, types of navigability that confuse people all the time. If you look at the definition in the statute, 3805-965-13, talks about the definition of navigability. It's very, very broad. If it's useful for any recreational purpose or it's hunting, fishing, trapping, it's navigable under statute, but it doesn't mean that we own it. The ownership test is the Daniel Ball federal case law test with the PPL Montana Incorporated. That's the standard that we fight when we do a quiet title action. But for public trust purposes, our Constitution, Article 8, Section 14, says that the people of the state have the right to access the navigable waters of the state as defined by the legislature. And the legislature has defined navigable as almost any public purpose, fishing, hunting, trapping, recreation. So notwithstanding the ownership of that land underneath it, the people have the right to access the waters in the state of Alaska, and it's a constitutional right. So, and we get into where the tension comes in is when BLM purported to convey a riverbed, and sometimes we believe they properly did it, and sometimes we believe they conveyed riverbeds that belong to the state. And but the underlying property owner, and it's usually a native corporation or a village corporation, believes they have the right to control who goes on that river, and so they sometimes will lease that exclusive right to a lodge or something, and then you get people that go out there to want to use the riverbed, and they're told, no, this is private property. So, but that's going to be an issue that's going to come to the forefront, because we're being pretty adamant that the public has the right to use it. Doesn't mean they can trespass on the upland.
Yeah.
And they have to know, they have to be able to legally access that water somehow. They can't trespass across an upland to get to that water. It doesn't give them that right. But it certainly gives them the right to be on that river.
And Mr. Oge, could you talk a little bit about the tension between, I think many of these lands were conveyed under NOLCA, or the Native Land Claim Settlement Act, and how that butts up against, you know, our Constitution and traditional land use. So what decides, who decides what law is supreme in that? Is that all the Supreme Court? Is that finally where it goes?
Ultimately, a court is the final arbitrator of a quiet title action, and you pretty much have to go to court to clear up that title if there's disagreement. There is a process that we have called the Recordable Disclaimer of Interest process, which is something that was negotiated between the state and the federal government, and it's actually a regulation on the books in the Code of Federal Regulations that allows us to, if the state and the BLM agree, and the BLM has that authority to disclaim all the navigable waters, even in Forest Service lands and all of Department of Interior lands, if we both agree that it's navigable, they'll disclaim an interest and clear the clouds to our title. The problem is that over the years, the state and the BLM have not always been on the same page or not always been diligent to make sure that the lands appropriately were conveyed. So there's been waxing and waning of different standards of navigability, and it's like trying to hold a bowl of Jell-O in your hands to try to get an answer out of the feds as to what is, what's your standard. So that's why we're in court right now on Mosquito Fork of the 40 mile. We want to reestablish that precedent that we thought we established under Gulkana, and in some cases they systematically removed any reference to Gulkana out of their navigability determinations. So it's caused a lot of problems because they conveyed lands that the state believes belong to the state, and have reversed themselves on navigability determinations over the years, used different criteria depending on.
Okay.
It's very, caused a lot of heartburn between Alaskans. So, again, I think I talked about access to navigable waters as a public right. This is an example of an ordinary high water mark. I use it to try to tell people if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. So if it looks like a riverbed, it's probably a riverbed, and that's defined on whether or not there's upland vegetation. And there's, you get a room of ordinary high water mark experts, or get a room full of people that are supposedly experts in it. I went to a conference on that one time, and it was so contentious the second day of the conference melted down almost into a verbal Donnybrook over whose standard. I mean, it's, when you get a whole bunch of learned people in a room, it's a subjective, kind of subjective art, and people that own land on boundaries defined by an ordinary high watermark that is an ambulatory boundary depending on what the river's doing. Now, Matanuska River is a good example. It causes a lot of heartburn. We have a gentleman in DNR that does nothing but riparian boundary determinations, and he's in the survey section. So we're in a quiet title action on a Mosquito Fork of the 40 mile. This happens to be a picture of that. The BLM says that river that our boats are navigating on isn't navigable. And it quiets other claims to our title. They're expensive. They're time-consuming. It's an uncertain outcome. They're very necessary when no other option exists. And hopefully we can build on that cornerstone of that case law to have less contention in the future. Again, I think I talked a little bit about the recordable disclaimer of interest. They're cost effective. They cost about $50,000 apiece versus upward of $1 million apiece for quiet title action. We have the only successful recordable disclaimer of interest process in the United States. And one of the first things I did when I took this job was to get that process up on step and make it work.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. Mr. Rogan, why is it $1 million generally to get a quiet title?
These things are very, very, Kent Solomon, our attorney for RS-2477, will give you an idea of how difficult these cases are. You know, some points of law you can just do on a summary judgment because you're arguing points of law. These have to be, you have to go into an extensive title search. You have to go into the field. You have to do hydrological research, find out how much water is going through there, how deep it is, how fast it is. You have to uncover historical use. They're very, very labor intensive. All these quiet title actions are. They're not a simple. It's really hard to describe, but you have to. Kent's really good at making sure that we don't leave any stones unturned, and anticipate every possible thing that could make our claim non-sufficient. And do you care to comment on that?
Yeah, I certainly could. Representative Isaacson, through the chair.
Identify yourself.
Yeah. I'm Kent Sullivan with Department of Law, Natural Resources Section, and I'm the attorney that focuses primarily on RS-2477, which does involve quiet title actions frequently. And the reason that they're as expensive as they are, as opposed to the recordable disclaimer of interest process, is because in order to bring a case and take it to court, These cases are very, very, very fact-intensive, and they're historically based. And so there's a tremendous amount of research that goes into putting the case together. You're having to, unlike a case that you might bring for instance, on breach of contract, where the parties walk into the court with a copy of the contract and say, okay, here's the contract, and they either agree it was signed or not signed, and this, let's argue about the law. You know, that's what happens in a breach of contract case. In a quiet title case, you're always arguing about the facts and the facts that happened historically, as well as the facts, like for instance in a navigability case, on what's happening today, expert witnesses to testify as to the hydrological aspects of the stream, and putting all that information together, in addition to all the other parties and parcels that might be involved, is a very fact-intensive effort. And the reason the recordable disclaimer of interest process is cheaper and easier is because you're not needing to present it to a court to actually have a decision on. The parties are basically agreeing to something because we're giving our evidence to the BLM and we're saying, okay, we think this is sufficient. You're not having to give such a level of evidence that you would before a court. You're trying to get them to say, okay, we agree this is enough. Yes, it's enough. We don't need to have quite as many experts. We don't need to have quite as many hydrological reports. We're okay with this. We don't need to have you present dozens of witnesses. It's okay if you present us an affidavit or two. It really cheapens the process and simplifies it a lot over what you're required to do in a quiet title. I hope that makes sense.
Representative Isaac, continue.
Thank you. So that does help clarify, but how large or how small of a tract of land are we talking about? Are we talking about a complete water system, or are we just talking about an acre at a time?
It can be both. I'm speaking more sort of from the RS-2477 aspect of things, but it's very similar to what you would do in a navigability case. We have cases that I'll discuss later when I'm talking about RS-2477 where we've had a private party that's done a road blockage, okay? And rather than take 20 miles of road to court and dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of different landowners, we've elected in that case, because only one person is disputing the RS-2477, to simply file as to that person's property. In other words, to only quiet title as to that person's property. What you come away with is you come away with a judgment that is good only as to that person's property. So the court will say, yes, that's an RS-2477, but because you didn't include everybody, we're confirming the RS-2477 as to that parcel. And again, if that's the only person that's challenging you, that can be far easier and simpler and cheaper than doing a quiet title action as to a 20 mile stretch of road. In other instances, because lots of different parties are disputing the RS-2477 or may potentially dispute the RS-2477, we may very well bring a quiet title action involving dozens of miles of road. And we're doing just that here very soon up in the Chicken area. And those quiet title actions are far more complex than the single parcel, single party quiet title action. So they come in all different variations.
And Ms. Sullivan, I'd encourage you give shorter answers with less detail. Most of the time, my colleagues will be asking a general question. If they need more details, they can pursue it.
One final question on this.
Certainly, Representative Isaacson.
And I appreciate the detail. The last final thing then is, because ownership changes and therefore perception of acceptability or whether or not there's navigability or RS-2477 legitimate claim, is that when instead of using the quiet title, you'll just put on the title a recordable disclaimer of interest so that you at least acknowledge the fact that there's not been any dispute for the usage? Or how does this quiet title and recordable disclaimer of interest interact then?
Yes, Representative Isaacson, through the chair. Actually, it's not quite like that. What it is that the recordable disclaimer of interest, once the parties agree to it and sign off on it, is as good as a judgment. It basically serves the same purpose. So it will be recorded against the property, just like a judgment would be recorded against the property. And that's what binds all future owners. So they're both bound in the same way. It's just a different process getting to that point.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Representative Hughes.
Yes, in that the quiet title action does cost $1 million. And Scott, you mentioned earlier that we've looked back and realized that there have been conveyances that the state believes shouldn't have happened. Once things like this are settled, is there any, how does it work to applying to conveyances that shouldn't happen? Does another suit have to be brought forward? Can this recordable disclaimer of interest be applied? Or I'm just wondering about the ones where it already went wrong and the money that we're spending on current things.
Thank you, Representative Hughes. It's a very astute question through the chair. It is a problem. In fact, when I served in this body, we passed a bill called Senate Bill 305, which instructed the Department of Natural Resources to send letters to all the native corporations and inform them that BLM may have erroneously conveyed lands to them and that are actually state-owned, and that they look at these lands and request that BLM not charge that against their acreage entitlement, and that they be able to select upland acres instead of those submerged lands. We thought we were going to be pretty much flooded, and BLM thought we were going to be pretty much flooded with people interested in doing this. It was not much of a blip on the radar screen. That's probably the best solution, short of quiet title actions. We have applied for recordable disclaimers of interest on rivers where there is a mixed bag of ownership, and we believe BLM erroneously conveyed submerged lands to native corporations, and we suspect, and I hope that it'll put the native corporations on notice that they're owning riverbeds that really they got charged, their acreage entitlement was charged for those riverbeds, and that might be the motivation that will get them to approach BLM to reconsider and give them some more upland acreage. So hopefully that'll be the resolution. We don't have enough time or enough lifetimes to litigate all those.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. Anyway, there's been a slight shift in BLM's attitude on recordable disclaimers of interest with RS-2477, and that's been driven by Utah's actions to apply title on like 18,000 RS-2477s in the state of Utah. It's a massive effort that they've got going along with some other neat stuff they're doing. Our current litigation issues, and I'll try to get through this to give other people time. We filed a quiet title action on the Mosquito Fork. We are being sued by Otna on the Cotsina River. Fog Lake Dream Creek out in the Bristol Bay area is one of these rivers that is contentious because certain lodges have exclusive rights to guide their clients on that river in conflict with the people's rights to access those rivers. We're being sued by a company on Lemon Creek, and the issue there is whether or not BLM inappropriately conveyed submerged lands before statehood. The state believes we have a pretty good case that those lands were held in trust for the future state, and so that issue will probably be answered in Lemon Creek, which frankly something we need an answer to. Skagway, we just settled a 25-year dispute with a gentleman that was mining in a state riverbed there. And then, of course, there's the Sturgeon Nation River case, which is, I think, probably one of the watershed cases that we have that will determine how far the federal jurisdiction extends into state rivers, and if it's airboats today, what's it going to be tomorrow? You know, so I think it's very. We have great concern. Mosquito Fork. We issued state mining claims on that river. It's a wild and scenic river. The feds have determined non-navigable. we filed a complaint. BLM denied all our issues. We're in discovery phase, which is a very special thing. If you ever sued the feds, they're really good at discovery. And we've floated it a number of times in all kinds of conditions and done a lot of hydrological work. It's a pretty remote river, but it's basically we had a state mining claim, and a guy went out there and was getting ready to start up his dredge. And I mean, we believe that river's unquestionably navigable. And so a federal officer came up and threatened to cite him if he started up the dredge, and that got the whole thing going. Katsina River, this is kind of an interesting one. You see this big braided area. What's below ordinary high watermark? Where is that high watermark? We believe it's the entire delta. These alluvial fans are called, they're like a fire hose in slow motion. They go back and forth, and they have tremendous bed loads because it comes out of a steep mountainous area, and so they carry a lot of gravel with them. And Matanuska River is a good example. So we're in a dispute with Otten over that. Fog Lake, Dream Creek I mentioned, Lemon Creek I mentioned, Skagway I mentioned. This one's Sturgeon Nation River. This is an interesting one. I'm standing literally on the border. If you look going up that hill, there's a cut going up the hill. That's the Alaska-Canada border. And around the turn of the century, the USGS went out there and surveyed that line. And they hired guys to haul supplies up and meet them right at the spot. And they hauled them up with a Peterborough canoe and about 1,000 pounds of gear. It took them 30 days to drag that thing up the river by hand, pretty much lined it and pulled it up the river. And the Ninth Circuit said that's commercial travel, trade, and commerce, and it's navigable. That's a pretty small river. That's about the smallest river we have adjudicated as navigable. So we're looking at that one pretty closely.
Mr. Hogan, at least four of us at this table are very interested in Matanuska River and so on, just because of the meandering river taking out some private property. If indeed the whole alluvial fan of a braided river is state jurisdiction, two questions then. If private property they've got entitled to land that extends into the that fan, what are the ownership deals there? And then a second question, because of flooding, if people or the state try to restore the river's active course to somewhere where it's been before but does less damage, who has jurisdiction over that?
The courts are full of those cases, and it's all on a case-by-case basis, but generally speaking, the title to the bed moves with the bed of the river. So if it's a state-owned riverbed and you're a riparian owner, an upland owner on that river, if generally under general title or case law, if there's an accretion, in other words, if the river is adding soil in your front yard and it's gradual and imperceptible, that accretion belongs to the upland owner. If there's a reliction and it's gradually taken it away, but it's not really perceptible, then that belongs. That land belongs to the state. If it's avulsion, which is a sudden and perceptible act, it fixes the boundary, and then you go from there, and then you can read all day long for weeks the case law on it. There's a book called I think it's Riparian Boundaries or something like that. That's a noted national expert, and we hire national experts on these cases to figure out where these boundaries are as expert witnesses. And you know, it's tough because it's a boundary that moves, and it's subject to subjective interpretation at times.
All right. So if I understood what you meant when you talked about the whole alluvial plain, then for all of, you know, the last 10,000 years, the river has basically been meandering back and forth within that fan. So if the river's channel stays within that plan that limits the whole course of where it's gone, then, but so when you talk about depositing or eroding and so on and so forth, I would think it would still stay within that wide fan.
Generally speaking, yes, but there's exceptions. It's a case-by-case basis, and if that river movement, there are some Supreme Court cases where there's been dams built and dikes built, and that land has been considered an accretion. In other words, it starts looking like an upland. It gets upland soil and things like that, upland vegetation and upland soil, you know, mineralized soil. Then it can accrete to be upland and potentially belong to the upland owner. And it's a Lawyer Employment Opportunity Act, you know. So.
All right. Thank you. Please continue.
I'll try to wrap this up. Skin boats. I did some research and found that there was a lot of skin boat use by natives in pre-statehood, and I believe that's the pre-statehood travel, trade, and commerce. I mean, subsistence, and they would typically go up in upper reaches of a river in the winter, late winter, when they could get across the frozen ground in the tundra, set up a camp, hunt, get all their stuff down to the village for the winter. Gulkana, standards of raft capable of carrying about 1,000 pounds. Miners typically use poling boats, and they poled and lined boats up rivers. And freight canoes, the Peterborough freight canoe used in Canandaigua Nation. My parents had a little island on a lake in Ontario, Canada, very close to Peterborough, Ontario, and that's everybody had Peterborough boats. I mean, and so I was very excited to find out that was actually, they were used in Alaska quite extensively. Love to get my hands on one. But what I did get my hands on was this historic poling boat out in the Chicken area, and we're out there working on that river, talking to some of the locals, and one of the guys said, "Oh, I know where one of those boats is." And so we went down and took a look at it. There it is. So I ran the idea of let's get an archaeological team out there and let's excavate it and get a boat builder to give us a set of plans so we can calculate how big and how much cargo would carry, and this is the only example we have of this. So here we are excavating that boat out, and we got Dave Seaman from Homer is the Alaska's noted wooden boat builder, and he came out and created a set of working drawings for one. So I think this is a real, what we do know about it is that this is pre-statehood and it was used in the 40-mile area, and other than that, we're trying to find out more
about. So just by curiosity, are you going to call it the John Hajdukovich Memorial Park or something?
Well, I don't know about that, but this was a big deal for me. I'm a wooden boat nut, as the chairman knows, and that's it for my presentation. And
I just have a question. I've been wondering this whole time whether navigability ever has included when the rivers are frozen and they're being used for transportation in the frozen state, but maybe they wouldn't be navigable when they're not frozen.
Very astute question, through the chair, Representative Hughes. But we do have case law that we do not consider frozen rivers a test for navigability. And we also do not consider just simple flow plane use. And those are both based on case law. The flow plane case was the slop bucket case, it's called. I don't recall the name of the frozen river one, but they have to be navigable in an ordinary condition. And they're ordinarily frozen, but you can't use the boats on them then, unless you're my boss who has an ice boat, so that he sails out on the lakes in the valley.
I would just say the ordinary condition in Alaska in some of those rivers would be frozen, so I would question that.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Scott, going back to that idea of the rivers moving and meandering, and you're looking down and you can see how the channels have been differently, and you said if it's a meander, the ownership changes. If it's a sudden occurrence, then the ownership is fixed?
That's generally correct, but they might own you know, like a flood event takes out their front yard, they might own that riverbed out there, which isn't going to do them much good. But generally speaking, that's the and again, these are all kind of subjective, and there's rooms full of people that are experts that will agree to disagree on those exactly what those criteria are.
Thank you. So if it's suddenly a sudden occurrence, but it doesn't swamp your property, it actually goes the opposite direction, and now you suddenly have a large front yard, let's say, because it moved the other way. Whose ownership is that?
That's Representative Isaacson through the chair. That's an excellent question. There's a case that I'm thinking of out on Arolic River where miners made a road next to the river, and the river ended up getting water, kept funneling down there, and the channel eventually moved over there and abandoned the existing riverbed. And the state's position is that we own that portion of riverbed there that was abandoned, and that because it was an revulsive act, and the new riverbed is owned by the upland owner, even though that it's navigable, it would be technically the state, but we believe our riverbed is the abandoned one because it was created by an revulsive act. And revulsive act can be a natural or man-made occurrence. But then there's other case law that disagrees with that philosophy, and specifically in Colorado River and state of Arizona, sued to acquire title to a riverbed they believe they owned after a dam was put in, and the court ruled that no, that that's accreted land and it belongs to the upland owner, which happens to be BLM or a federal agency. So, you know, some of my friends think this way and some of my other friends think that way, and I always agree with my friends.
Representative Isaac.
Thank you. I'm thinking in terms of development or when you have a large body, and I'm glad you brought up Colorado. I'm thinking in Omaha by Effley Field, for example, there's a section by Carter Lake that is Iowa, because the Missouri River changed its boundaries, I guess, suddenly, and stranded Iowans in the middle of Nebraska, in the middle of Omaha. Yeah. What if that were to happen up here? Is that going to be contested ownership, or is that going to be fixed to those who were there? And so you don't have to go through the idea, well, this is now federal land, or this is now state land. It's whose ever land that was.
Representative Isaacson through the chair. It all depends on whose ox is getting gored and who wants to raise the issue. You know, I mean, I sometimes tell people, you know, don't ask a question you don't know the answer to or don't want to know the answer to. There's good examples of in those riparian boundary books that I look at that where state lines were formed on a riverbed and it evolved. And so, you know, they're living on the other side of the river when everybody else in their state is over there, and they're over here, but they're still in the state with the rest of the people on the other side of the river. So that's a classic example of an evulsive event.
Okay. And Mr. Hogan, two things. So in the example where the river is eroding some private property, but the owner of the property still owns out to, you know, the original boundary, is that private property owner, can he go back and backfill on his property out to where it was?
If he gets his 404 permits, yeah, possibly.
From who?
From the Corps of Engineers.
They
take a dim view on your backfilling out of the waters.
All right. And then do you ever get into Fifth Amendment problems where the state ends up, in essence, taking land that was perceived to be private property?
I'm not sure that's Fifth Amendment, but I think, but the, well, we don't consider it a taking because it's riparian law. I mean, I'm not sure I can answer your question. Chair, take a stab at that one.
Mr. Sullivan.
Senator Dyson, yes. There is some case law out there that says, for instance, in the RS-2477 context where challenges have been made and quiet title actions have been filed and private landowners have said that potentially there's a takings issue. However, in the one case that I'm thinking of, that was the Widener case, the court actually ruled that the statute of limitations had passed on the takings, that because the whatever had happened with the RS-2477 had happened so long ago, it was beyond the statute of limitations, so the court refused to grant any relief for the takings. So it's an issue that to my knowledge, has not come up frequently, and it may be that okay. very reason. It may be because things are so
slow. Right. Please continue.
I'm done. I'd like to leave time for Mr. Sullivan and
right. our captain. Any questions for Mr. Ogan? Please, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you very much.
And I want to, if we can, get through your portion of this by 9, and because we have another presentation we want to hear from the CACTA people.
Thank you, members of the Joint Committee. Thank you for having me back today. And I'll pick up where we left off with regard to the last time that I was before you, and skip down to some examples of Alaska's better known RS-2477s. And this is the Dalton Highway, Farmers Loop Road in Fairbanks, DeBar Road in Anchorage, Utina Lake Road at a Copper Center, the Iditarod Trail, and the Chilkoot Trail. But there's a lot of variations in RS-2477s. They don't all look the same, particularly in Alaska. We have RS-2477s that are everywhere from footpaths to major highways like we've seen. These are some RS-2477s in the Chicken area. This is Chitna Cemetery Road near Chitna. This particular RS-2477 was created to serve a cemetery above the town of Chitna at the turn of the century. This is RST-421, the Chicken Ridge Trail near Chicken, Alaska. This is an extremely heavily used trail by hunters and miners. During the fall, during caribou and moose hunting season, there will literally be hundreds and hundreds of four-wheelers that go over this trail during a several-week period. Why are RS-2477s important to Alaska? Alaska is the largest state in the country, but it actually has fewer public roads than Connecticut, the third smallest state in the country. Alaska has roughly 16,000 miles of public road, and Connecticut has 21,000 miles. Again, you've all seen this image before, but if you take into consideration that we as the largest state have fewer miles than Connecticut over their way off to the right, that's pretty amazing. Here's a diagram that depicts the state highway system in Alaska without RS-2477s being considered. There is one RS-2477 that does show up there, that's the Dalton, but other than that, that's the state highway system without RS-2477. Here's the same general map with RS-2477, and you can see the far greater areas for development of travel corridors in this picture than in the previous diagram. Without RS-2477, we're very limited on what we might be able to do with regard to development of travel corridors in this state.
So, excuse me. Is there a site where we can go on and look at these maps in more detail?
They're on BASIS right now, so this entire presentation is on BASIS for today's hearing, and I assume that will be available for a while. I can certainly provide you stuff.
Oh, but can we see them in more detail?
I created these. There is the map that shows the RS-2477's mm-hmm. routes. That's on DNR's website. DNR has, and there's a link at the end of this presentation to that website.
Okay. Thank
and that's there. Yeah.
Thank you.
So the RS-2477s are important to provide public access to the state's land and resources, and in order to enable the state to reasonably manage and maintain and develop its land and resources, and to maintain state sovereignty and preserve state's rights. Previously, there was a RS-2477 project that began in the early 1990s and an effort by DNR to systematically review potential RS-2477s in the states. And that was done by researching Alaska Road Commission records, USGS maps, Postal Service records and contracts, and it culminated in the legislature's codification of over 600 routes in AS-1930-400. And in 2011, the legislature authorized an increment increase to DNR in order to further research and pursue RS-2477 in the state. And since that increment increase, the PAD unit, the Public Access Assertion and Defense Unit from DNR, has conducted extensive field work and historical research related to RS-2477s. They've also recruited and had Department of Law hire an attorney dedicated to RS-2477 work. That's myself. And they engaged in peer-to-peer meetings with representatives from Utah in figuring out how best to pursue RS-2477. Utah is years ahead of us in its efforts to pursue RS-2477. So we've had representatives from the Utah Attorney General's office come up here, and we've met with them. We've also, Scott Ogan, myself, and some other members from PAD have went down to Utah and actually taken a look at their RS-2477s. And what we tried to do is we want to learn from their successes, and we also wanted to learn from some of the mistakes that they've made, again, because they have so much more history in dealing with them. And we further refined and developed Alaska's RS-2477 prosecution strategy based upon that information that we learned. And we decided that it's very, very careful, it's very important to carefully select the initial claims to prosecute. We don't want to establish bad case law. One of the earlier questions was, can we do things in one quiet title case, and how will that impact other situations that are similarly situated? And it's through the establishment of that precedent that you can actually have one case affect other similar situations. You know, there may not be existing case law on a particular issue right now, but if you succeed in court in getting an issue resolved, then you can take that precedent and you can apply it to other situations. And that's why it's incredibly important to put your best foot forward in these initial early RS-2477 cases, and we want to make sure that we do that. We also prepared a detailed analysis of what's needed to take an RS-2477 case to trial. What's needed to take a case to trial can be somewhat different than what's needed in order to make a preliminary determination that an RS-2477 may exist. Again, if you're going to go to trial and if you're going to be challenged on something, the level of evidence that you're going to want to have at your disposal in going to trial is going to be huge. You're going to want to make sure that you've left no stones unturned. But in simply going out there and making a quick preliminary determination that an RS-2477 likely exists takes a far lesser level of evidence. And so we want to buttress what was done in the early 90s to make sure that if we're challenged on any of these cases, on any of these 600 right-of-ways, that we have enough support to succeed in trial. And that's important to do, is to further supplement those files. And the other thing that's important is to identify key witness testimony. Because in Alaska, in order to create an RS-2477, it had to be done before all federal lands were withdrawn in Alaska, prior to state selection and ANCSA selection in 1969, a witness that's going to have knowledge as to an RS-2477 is going to be fairly old today, and we're losing those witnesses every day. We want to make sure that we identify those witnesses and that we preserve their testimony to the extent that we can. With regard to what's happened recently since I've been working on RS-2477 for approximately the last year, is, like I mentioned earlier, we had a private landowner up in the Chickaloon area who blocked an RS-2477 right away. And that was actually in a residential neighborhood. That was a right-of-way that wasn't just being used by recreationalists, but it was used by homeowners in the area. And it was actually a loop road that connected to the Glen Highway. So what the landowner did is the landowner felled a bunch of trees across the road and then erected a detour sign, which forced people to drive up his loop driveway within 5 or 10 or 15 feet of his house and back out the other side. When they drive up his driveway, he'd come out and stop them, tell them to slow down, tell them it wasn't a public right-of-way, and allow them to go on. Well, this obviously created an issue for, you know, safety and emergency reasons. Didn't want to provide the landowner an opportunity to harass people using a public right-of-way. Didn't want to interfere with emergency vehicle services, people quickly needing to be able to take somebody to the hospital or have police arrive. And so the state sued to enjoin Mr. Lone Wolf and prevent him from doing that. And we actually got a default against Mr. Lone Wolf. We got an injunction initially and a default against him. And so are soon going to likely get judgment in that case. This is a picture of that particular road.
You helped me too. The injunction stopped him from filling up my inbox.
Did it? Well, it served multiple purposes, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then another case we have is Dixon versus State. And in Dixon, two out-of-state private landowners near Kinnick sued the state seeking to prevent use of a portion of the historic Iditarod Trail. This matter is continuing in litigation. This trail is important not only because it's a portion of the historic Iditarod Trail, but it's also used and has been used extensively to conduct various races. Historically, the Iditarod race went across this trail until the landowner blocked it in 1982. But even since then, there's another RS-2477 route that's been used across the property for the junior Iditarod races and a lot of the other Iditarod races, or a lot of the other Iditarod qualifying events. And this matter continues to be actively litigated.
We're running out of time. Can you tell us the things we need to know?
You bet. Just two more things. One is a case involving Clutina Lake Road that was filed by the Otna Corporation. Even though the Clutina Lake Road is one of Alaska's most historical rich RS-2477s because it's part of the Valdez to Copper Center Trail, OTNA initiated litigation claiming it wasn't an RS-2477. Again, that case continues to be litigated. And finally, we've prepared a draft complaint for some litigation in the Chicken area involving at least seven RS-2477s in that location. These RS-2477s are many, many miles long. It involves dozens and dozens and dozens of miles of road up in that country. Occurring across numerous parcels of private property, federal property, mining claims, and a large number of parcels. So it's like the question that was raised about, you know, do we do a quiet title action as to just one part of property, or do you involve numerous parcels of property? This is a big one here, and that case is soon going to be filed.
Thank you. Representative Keller has a question.
That's all I have.
Thank you. As you know, Kent, I've seen your presentation a couple of times, and I'm just really grateful for what your work for the state. It's been about, year and a half that you've really pulled some things together here. The question I have, just for your opinion, you don't have to answer this, but as you're watching, RS-2477 is incredibly important to us. I mean, on the list, you know, let's get up there. But are we in danger of the state, just from standing back looking? Are we in danger by not having a corner of government where we deal with the broader issues of federal overreach? You know, what comes to mind, we're going to be hearing from CACFA next, you know, there's issues always related to ESA, Endangered Species Act, I can go on and on with the different things that come up. But do you think we're missing something by not having, you know, other attorneys in this area or a corner of the Department of Law or DNR or something, you know, to focus more on the federal overreach? It's kind of a broad, sweeping question, but I would like to get your perspective as being relatively new in focusing on the RS-2477s.
Yes, Representative Keller, through the chair. That's a good question, and I can't speak for Department of Law on that. I can give you my own perception, and my own perception is that federalism issues and federal overreach issues are a very important part of the whole analysis, and they factor into it a great deal. But it's not the only part. RS-2477, for instance, itself involves a lot of state law as well as federal law, and it can't be simply prosecuted from a federal perspective. They overlap. And so if you had an attorney that was simply looking at federalism issues or federal overreach, you'd only be able to address but a portion of RS-2477. Again, I can't speak as to navigability. I can't speak as to other areas. But with regard to RS-2477 itself, it really is a mix of issues. And as these cases represent, we have cases right now, the previous three I talked about, are all in state court. And none of those three involve a federal party. But we have this last one, which is going to be in federal court and does involve the federal government. And so, again, it's a real mix, and it's difficult to isolate it out.
Representative Hughes.
Considering that the witnesses are very key and they're aging, is there anything that we need to do to step it up as far as collecting their doing the research while they're still alive? Are we adequately funding, for instance? Do you need help? Just how can we assist?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, we're certainly doing everything we can within our budget restraints, and at this point, a lot of that research is going on. You know, we're trying to do many different things from many different angles, and that is one of them. And so, you know, obviously, in everything that we do, more can be done. But I think we're doing what needs to be done right now, but certainly we could always do more.
So you feel like it's the program right now is robust enough that you'll be able to gather the information you need before the witnesses are gone?
That's a, Representative Hughes, through the chair, that's a difficult question to answer. You know, obviously, I think if a person were out there, you know, going to every pioneer's home and contacting everybody that could be contacted, clearly you'd be able to identify more witnesses and do more than what we're doing today. But that's, you know, the same as with everything. Obviously, if resources were unlimited, people would be able to do different things than you can do now, and they're not, and you know, we're happily working within our budget. So we're doing what we can. Yes.
All right, we're out of time. Thank you very much, and thank you for what you do. I'm hearing that you're a hero and doing well.
Thank you.
Which is, online we have Joanne Blackburn in Anchorage. Can you hear us, Joanne?
Yes, I can. I can hear you. Thank you for this opportunity to discuss RS-2477 and the outgrowth of development, possibly along the issues of defining tidelands. There are some guiding principles and settled law regarding riparian rights within the United States, and I agree with Mr. Ogun that the equal footing doctrine was established by federal courts, and those certainly have application here in Alaska. I find an irony that the state of Alaska has not placed an RS-2477 on the railroad tracks, which is the exact area where the Iditarod Trail was run at 20 Mile. No one who loved their dogs or was in a hurry to save lives would have run their dogs up on the ledges and precipices that we see. They ran along the bottom of the valley, and it is agreed by the co-contractors, the Federal Department of Agriculture, the U.S. Forest Service, and their partner, the Alaska Railroad Corporation, that the railroad itself is the exact highway, superhighway, that was used for this transportation. And this corridor has not been claimed for the people of the state of Alaska. The railroad was built in 1923, I believe, under the 1875 Licensing Act. And so what was obtained by the federal operation of the railroad was a public permeable right-of-way. This infrastructure is aging and is actually going faster and heavier and is sinking into the riparian mud. Ironically, they have claimed a private parcel arising out of tidelands on either side of their private parcel, the patent of which they derived from not the BLM, but the U.S. Department of Transportation. And
Joanne,
in 1959...
Joanne, I'm sorry, we are really time constrained this morning.
I have 2 minutes, please.
I think you've had it. Summarize, please.
Yes, I am summarizing. So what I would say is, if we do not have the political will to apply RS-2477, what exactly are we spending our money on? This is the original historic Iditarod Trail, the superhighway. At some point, new design and new infrastructure will be built. Where exactly is our claim to the actual Iditarod Trail? It does not exist. This is a glaring omission, and by virtue of that, I lose confidence. Secondly, the one thing I would add is that under the equal footing doctrine, no federal agency can lean upon the fledgling state and take their assets. Real estate is handled like real estate anywhere else. It can be any owner.
All right, Joanne.
Federal or state.
Thank you for your testimony.
We need a series
please
of
stand by, and if we get time, we'll come back to you. And thank you.
You're welcome.
Now we're going to go to Mr. Liepart from Katkus. Sorry that time has gotten away from us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity. For the record, my name is Stan Liepart. I'm the executive director of the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas. And
pull up the mic there. Choke up on the bat a little, please.
All right. Yes, sir. Okay. I have a presentation here. I'm going to go through the background of the commission fairly quickly because I kind of like to get to the meat and potatoes of what we do. But the commission was originally created by the state legislature in 1981. We operated until 1999, when we lost state funding. The primary reason for the commission was the passage of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, the act that we all have come to know and love for these last 32 years. It was originally established just as a temporary advisory agency and authorized initially for 7 years. And ANILCA came with some time limits for agencies to complete their planning, and I think we were all a little naive and thought 7 years would be enough time to get a handle on this new piece of legislation and all the new areas that it created. As you can see, it was reauthorized in 1988 for 10 years and then in 1998 for an additional 5 years, but we closed down before we were able to complete that. Now, in 2007, Representative Kelly sponsored a bill along with Senator Coghill to reestablish the commission, and we resumed our operations in 2008 and are currently scheduled to sunset at the end of June next year. It's a 12-member commission. The membership is supposed to represent the regions of the state in order to have a geographical balance. The governor appoints 6 members. The Speaker of the House appoints three members, one of those being a member of the House, and the President of the Senate appoints one state senator and two members of the public. And the public members, the statute directs that they be representative of the diversity of users and uses of federal land in the state. And you can see our current membership. We just 2 weeks ago had a resignation, so we're one member short, but we welcomed our newest member at our last meeting on Friday, and that's Senator Coghill. And, we're happy to have him with us. And of course, Representative Keller is our chairman, and he's been...
We can read that.
I'm sorry?
We can read it.
Okay, I'm sorry. The duties of the commission. These are pretty straightforward. Shall consider, research, and hold hearings on the consistency with federal law and congressional intent on management, operation, planning, development, and additions to federal management areas in the state. And early on, Senator Betty Fahrenkamp, who was our first chairman, she interpreted that to mean we watch what the federal agencies do, and we watch them very closely. So I'm going to move on. The authorization, the commission may request the Attorney General to file suit against a federal agency if we think that they're violating federal law or not acting in accordance with their own regulations or guidelines. And we've done that a couple of times. A state filed suit against the National Park Service against their cabin regulations that were adopted in the late 1980s. Unfortunately, we lost that case. Actually, it was dismissed for lack of standing. But agency cooperation, we work pretty closely with other state agencies. We're part of the Department of Natural Resources, but the staff of the commission answers to the commission, but we work closely with the other agencies. Administrative, as I said, we're part of the Department of Natural Resources. We have two staff members. We're located at the DNR Northern Region Office in Fairbanks, and we meet three times a year, usually Anchorage, Juneau, and Fairbanks. And that's our website there. On that website, you'll find all our annual reports, all the correspondence and comments that we submit, our newsletter, which is published once a month electronically. And I think I put copies of the latest one out on the table in the hall. Our working relationship. Our primary duty or the primary exercise is reviewing public land management agency documents, planning documents, regulations, policies, analyzing those, talking to the public, and then submitting comments on those planning documents. We work with the ANILCA program, but the state ANILCA program, which is also housed within DNR, but we're independent of that program. Our main focus is to try to talk to members of the public, user groups, interest groups, organizations, and find out their concerns with respect to these federal land management issues. So that's the focus we try to stay on. And of course, we work with our congressional delegation. We found them very helpful sometimes in dealing with federal agencies that overstep their bounds. So tends to get a federal park superintendent's attention if they get a call from Senator Murkowski's office or Congressman Young's office. So they've been a big help for us over the years. Real quickly, ANILCA, Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, it came out of 17D2 of the Native Claims Settlement Act, where the Secretary was directed to withdraw up to 80 million acres for the purpose of creating parks, refuges, wild and scenic rivers, wilderness areas, those sorts of things. And of course, that debate went on for about 8 years before ANILCA was finally passed in December of 1980. So, real quickly on the what we're dealing with in terms of areas in the state, we have 17 national park areas, 51 million acres, 32 million acres of that is designated wilderness, and that, if you probably know, is the most restrictive classification of federal land that exists. National Wildlife Refuge is 16 refuges, 76 million acres. More than 90% of the acres in the total refuge system is here in Alaska. 18 plus million acres of that is designated wilderness. Two national forests, 22 plus million acres. The only wilderness areas in the forest land is in the Tongass, and that totals about 7 million acres. There are two wilderness study areas in Chugach National Forest, and those are managed as if they were wilderness because they're congressionally designated study areas. The BLM has three designated areas. They also manage six wild and scenic rivers. There's 26 total wild and scenic rivers in the state. That's almost 3,200 river miles. One national trail system, that's the Iditarod National Trail. So all together in designated federal areas, we have around 154 million acres of the state. And here's a map. It's not a very, very clear map, but you can see the extent to which these conservation system units stretch around the state. The sort of red-brown areas are national wildlife refuges. The blue areas are national park units. And then if you can see them, they're not very clear. The blue lines represent wild and scenic rivers. And, of course, the national forests are the Tongass and the Chugach. So that's the lands we deal with. I'm just going to skip over that. These are the plans that have been developed over the last 32 years. A lot of those plans are old now. A lot of the park plans are 25 years old, and they're in the process of being revised. The BLM, as part of their Eastern Interior management plan that they're working on, they're dealing with three of those wild and scenic rivers that they managed and the two units that they managed, the Steese White Mountain and White Mountain areas. So I wanted to share with the committees this three lawsuits that were filed because it's representative of the shift that's taken place since the passage of ANILCA. Northern Alaska Environmental Center v. Evison, Boyd Evison was the regional director for the Park Service. This essentially terminated all mining in these three park units in the state. There were literally thousands of claims in these three areas. Some of the claims are still in existence. To my knowledge, they have not approved a plan of operation since roughly 1985. Kantishna Mining District, of course, was added to Denali National Park and Preserve, and none of those folks have mined. Some of them have been compensated for their loss, but those mining claims no longer are active. Sierra Club v. Pinfall, this actually involves the three wild and scenic rivers, three of the six wild and scenic rivers managed by BLM, and the result of that suit changed the way people were able to mine, again, in two historic mining districts, Circle Mining District and 40 Mile Mining District, had a major impact on placer mining and those Birch Creek and 40 Mile. Alaska Wildlife Alliance v. Jensen.
Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
I want to leave time for some questions.
Yes, sir.
And first, when it comes to mine, we've heard testimony that Utah is, done pioneer work, and they have some kind of an organization there. Is that like Katka?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding is quite different. We've had a couple of briefings. Their focus is to look primarily, if I understand it correctly, at the failure of the federal government to honor their state's compact.
Right.
Our focus is much more designed to kind of sort of soften the blow, if you will, of federal management. So that's significantly different there. And we're strictly an advisory group.
And theirs has some policy power, do they not?
My understanding is that they do.
Okay, we can find out about that.
Right.
And then what do you know that we need to know, and what would you like us to do?
Well, this next slide, it gives you an idea of the management plans and policies and regulations that come out of the federal agencies just last year. This is about 14,000 pages of material, and all of these dictate how those 150 million acres are managed. And they become the guidebook, if you will, for that area, for that park or that refuge. And those are referred to continually by the managing agency. So if we don't review those plans and make sure that they're complying with the special provisions in ANILCA. And that's a key point. ANILCA is a very unique piece of legislation because Congress and our congressional delegation recognize special situations that exist up here. People in Alaska are much closer to the land. In fact, depend on those federal lands much more so than almost any other state. So there are these special provisions, and what we've found over the last 32 years is those federal agencies have gradually chipped away at those special provisions. There are provisions regarding access, there are provisions regarding hunting and fishing activities. There are supposed to be recognition of valley existing mining rights, and I just told you how that played out with the park unit. So the bottom line is that I know the public is overwhelmed. I talk to people, they're interested in these plans, talk to people that are working on the eastern interior with individual miners. They are look at a 1,400 page plan, and they are just overwhelmed. And if you multiply that several times over, it's extremely difficult for everybody to keep up. And I guess, quite frankly, we're kind of outmanned and outgunned. The ANILCA team is a great program. Sue McGee does an excellent job of coordinating state comments from Department of Fish and Game and Department of Natural Resources, but it's very difficult to dedicate a number of employees' times just to ANILCA-related issues. And ANILCA, as important as it is, as big as it is, it's not the only federal law that we deal with. We deal with the Endangered Species Act. We deal with a whole bunch of other acts that apply to, say, Forest Service management. BLM management, Federal Land Policy and Management Act. So there's just a huge level of planning and activity that goes on. I was with the original commission for its first tenure, and I've been back the whole time for this one. I've never seen this much activity since the very early days of ANILCA when they were writing the first line of plan. So it's an extremely busy time. Policies are changing constantly. What we're finding is that agencies just don't pay much attention. They have no institutional memory anymore, the federal agencies. Most of the people that were here early on and after ANILCA are gone. And so what we find is that they don't recognize all the agreements that were reached administratively, not what's in the legislation, but we had the Alaska Land Use Council, and you had a whole set of sort of helpers, if you will, to kind of craft this statute, and that's all gone now. So what we're finding is that there's a real steep learning curve for the federal agencies, people that come in here, and so we're faced with having them more or less import their lower 48 policies and management strategies to Alaska, and that's not what was supposed to happen.
So the answer to the first part of my question is, you wished we knew everything and were paying attention to all the last four or five pages. And you wished you had more horsepower to be able to keep up.
I know time is up.
I want to let Representative Isaacs in a question first.
Thanks. I just want to go back to that idea of being outmanned and outgunned. And you had mentioned that in the litigation, there were some people whose land had been taken and they had not yet been compensated. You said some have been compensated. That seems to be a very onerous omission. Is there something we should be doing that can help accelerate that? What's the fog? Is there any hope?
Well, Representative Eisen, through the chair, there was legislation that was passed by the delegation that set up a compensation system. The problem has been disagreement over the value of those claims. The National Park Service, after the lawsuit was settled, went in and invalidated as many claims as possible. An unpatented claim, if they determine it to be invalid, that you're not entitled to any compensation. There were a lot of patented claims in there. Some of those claim holders have been compensated. Some are still waiting to reach some agreement on what the compensation should be with the partnership. So
good. Representative Keller?
I want to pass because I want to give them an opportunity to go through the last couple slides.
Okay.
I might be for time. I can run through this pretty quick here. These are just the things that we're currently working on. One of the things I should point out, since we're talking a little bit about federal overreach, if you look on the National Park Service compendiums, park and preserve compendiums, these are a collection of regulations that are prepared for each park. Now, there are a lot of regulations that have to do with camping and where you can camp and where you can't, what areas are closed, what areas not. The big issue this year was that the National Park Service implemented a number of regulations to preempt state hunting regulations on national preserves. There were seven national preserves where the National Park Service, they had gone to the board informally, asked the board not to implement or adopt certain regulations. The board adopted those anyway. So the Park Service acted, exercised its authority to close those areas. The problem was that they have minimal public hearings. They're required by their own regulations to have public hearings. They had a minimal number of public hearings, and they never used the board process the way it was intended to be used. So that's been a real problem. The compendium process has improved over the last 20 years. The first ones I ever saw, I had to file a Freedom of Information Act to get. At least now they have a public process. But the bottom line is that the agency has failed consistently to follow its own procedures for implementing closures and restrictions. So that's a real a big one there. These are just the things that we know are coming down the pike. The two forest plants, one's going to undergo a full revision. The Tongass is going to go a five-year review, and that's going to be two major efforts. And, of course, these other areas are updates of existing plans. In the case of, for example, the Central Yukon plan, that plan's about 25 years old. There's another one that I think is that will bear watching, and that's the last one on the list there, and that's the BLM is conducting a guide capacity study. I think I hit the wrong button here, I'm sorry. Anyway, they are looking at guide capacity on their lands, and I think possibly, depending on the outcome of that study, they may be restricting the number of guides that they will be permitting to operate on their lands, and I think that's a major factor. These are the key issues that we look at when we look at a plan. I'm going to go straight to number two because everybody talks about the no more clause, and I took some time to put together a memo with some of the legislative history related to the so-called no more clauses, and I think it's in your packet. It's just put it there for information. I'm a historian by training and an Anilka aficionado by 30 by fault, I guess, but it explains that whole no more directive from Congress wasn't just a passing thought. It was given a lot of thought, and our delegation, based in part on requests made by the state legislature, made sure that no more clause was in ANILCA, and the agencies have consistently violated those no more clauses. There's actually a couple in there. This is just some suggested reading. The second one there is put together by Alaska Miners Association. They certainly look at this. It's got some excellent articles in there written by J.P. Changen and Bill Horn and Steve Burrell from the Alaska Miners Association. Land Gone Lonesome deals with cabin owners and Yukon Charley Preserves. And just to give you a little background on that, our commission went to Eagle in 1984 and held hearings to talk about Park Service cabin regulations. At that time, I think there were 14 families living in the preserve, and currently there's no one living in the preserve. So that's the basis of that. So this is just a little suggested reading if you have time. And this is a cartoon that was done back in the 80s by a fellow by the name of John Manley. And it kind of, we're still juggling. We're still trying to make this piece of legislation work. And sometimes those batons are used to beat us over the head with. So it's, anyway, Mr. Chairman, that's all I had, and I can happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, Representative Keller.
Oh, I have a hard time. I want to stomp my feet. I just want to recall one thing that Stan said. He said 14,000. That was just a one page of papers, and he sorts through. You got to understand, this is not a this is not a big group. I mean, this is Stan and the staff. 14,000 papers, and they condense things for the commission, and then the commission takes action, writes letters on various things, and it's been, in my estimation, effective. But the thing I wanted to emphasize is Stan has experience, background. If it was not for him, he's not running for anything, but I'm just telling you, this is an important corner of DNR that we have to pay attention to. This is critical stuff, and when he raises his hand and he's quiet and quietly says, help, 14,000, I'm getting inundated, I think I'd like to pay attention. So, thanks.
Yeah, and thank you, Representative Keller. We really need you to tell us what we can do to help, both statute and resources-wise, and we can continue that conversation. Mr. Ogun, would you come up here quickly and give us a minute on the issue with the Iditarod and the railroad bed that Ms. Blackburn raised?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The right-of-way into the railroad was something that was already in place at statehood, and I don't have specific firsthand knowledge of exactly where the route of the historic, I assume she's talking the Seward to Anchorage portion of the RS-2477. I don't have specific information exactly where it is, so I don't think I can sufficiently answer the question.
Yeah, we'd get back to us if you can find that easily, and thank you.
We'll do it, sure.
Any other questions or comments from the committee? Appreciate all of you and the work you're doing, and I agree that it's amongst the most important things going on. Perhaps not the most pressing, but in the long term, very, very important, and I commend you for your efforts.
Thank you for your support.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it, Chair.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you very much. Thank everybody who testified today. It's very, very interesting, very important to the future of our state. Our House State Affairs Committee will be meeting Thursday at usual time, usual place here. We consider governor's appointments for the State Commission on Human Rights and for the Board of Parole and bills previously heard. And with that, again, thank you to everybody participating. We appreciate the state affairs from the other body coming over here, and we are adjourned.